Perhaps you noticed that our gospel reading this morning is almost embarrassingly out of place. Here we are on the verge of Thanksgiving with only 32 shopping days before we celebrate the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem, and we find ourselves deposited in Jerusalem. More specifically, we find ourselves at Golgotha, the place of the skull, where criminals are publicly executed in a display of Roman imperial power. The Christmas wreaths have gone up on the streets of Atlanta. The holiday sales have all begun. We are looking forward to the cuteness of a cuddly baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, and the church calendar demands that we visit the cross one final time before our Christmas trees go up. This also seems an odd story for this day in the church year, celebrated as Christ the King Sunday. It is the final Sunday of the liturgical year before a new round of sacred seasons kicks off with the beginning of Advent next week. Christ the King Sunday is a great feast day of the church, a celebration of the lordship of Jesus Christ over heaven and earth. Crown him Lord of all. The problem is that Jesus does not look like much of a king from where we stand at Golgotha. The placard above his head, "This is the King of the Jews," well, that's a double-edged sword of ironic mockery. First, the Jews had no king in Jesus' day. Long gone were the powerful reigns of King David and Solomon. In the first century, the Jewish community was ruled, along with most of the known world, by the vast Roman Empire and its puppet king, Herod. Secondly, of course, Jesus looks nothing like a king at Golgotha. It would be hard for anyone to look triumphantly royal in Jesus' position. And all those who taunt him from the ground make it impossible for anyone to ignore the irony. If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. He saved others, he cannot save himself. Their words express the doubt pressing in on even the sturdiest of believers that day. What kind of king ends up like this? Today is the Sunday on which we Christians proclaim the kingship of Christ and anticipate God's eternal reign of righteousness and peace. But to those gathered before him, it looks as though Jesus' reign and his life are over. Of course, there is the chance that the message of Christ the King Sunday is equally out of place in our contemporary context. This reign of Christ that we proclaim today has not brought an end to violence or hatred. It has not ushered in righteousness like mighty waters. No lions have been seen peacefully grazing with flocks of sheep. Prosperity and well-being have not been distributed equally to all the peoples of the earth. The church, too, is suffering from lost influence, lost members, and lost dollars. In our own lives, in our collective life, and in this picture painted by Luke, the kingship of Christ can seem distant and overly optimistic at best, tragically mistaken at worst. But those who are gathered to watch and mock this spectacle of punishment are not the only people in the picture that Luke paints. next to Jesus, hanging on their own crosses, Luke pencils in two criminals. We know nothing about them, except that they have committed crimes, broken the Roman law in some serious way. They are on death row. Perhaps they, like Barabbas, had committed murder during the Jewish revolts against Rome. It is likely that the two criminals, like Jesus, were Jewish, oppressed Jews, who had seen enough of the kingdom of Rome and its tyrannical power, who longed for a return to the days of King David, when the people of God were mighty in battle and powerful players on the world stage. Luke gives both of the criminals hanging next to Jesus lines to speak. He is the only gospel author who does that. And with their words, Luke seems to summarize the perspectives of those who had followed Jesus with curiosity, maybe even hope, up until this tragic moment. The first criminal is indignant and resentful. If you are the Messiah, then can't you do something about this? His is the voice of one who is tired. Tired of the peaceful approach to regime change. His is the voice of one who desires divine intervention of a more convincing sort. He and all those who longed for a kingdom of force will be deeply disappointed in this King of the Jews hanging on the cross. It is the second criminal who seems to dimly perceive another possibility. Some whisper of faith left within him produces the words that are his enduring contribution to the Christian faith. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He must have actually believed that placard above Jesus' head, that this man really was a king. At the lowest of low points in Luke's passion story, there is one, only one, who recognizes a different kind of royalty. And so he boldly reaches out and asks for the crucified king to remember him. In this extraordinary moment of holy encounter, the condemned criminal becomes blessed disciple bound for paradise. Through the eyes of faith, God's power is not to be found on earthly thrones, but most deeply on a cross. If we Christians forget this basic and profound truth, if we follow the course of some and take down our crosses out of embarrassment or hope for broader appeal, then we deny the heart of who we are. The kingship of Christ is not a rebranded royalty that relies on the same systems of tyranny and abuse that were Rome's hallmarks. No, the kingdom of God is a reinvented royalty, one characterized by compassion, forgiveness. And so Luke uses the image and the voice of a convicted criminal on death row to teach us that the kingdom of God is something altogether different, something that fits awkwardly like a square peg into the round hole of our preconceived notions of kingship. If it is true that this event at Golgotha is the revelation of the deepest truth about the character of God, then our whole way of seeing the world is turned upside down. Everything, especially our perception of power, has to be reevaluated in the shadow of the cross. A few years ago at Columbia Theological Seminary, a group of 7 theological scholars and leaders from all over the world gathered for 3 months of research and discussion on this very important question: what is the role of the church in an age of religious violence? Today, the question is as current as the morning news. What is the role of the church in an age of religious violence? When the group presented their initial report to the seminary community, Dr. Eberhard Busch, a student of Karl Barth and professor of theology in Switzerland, spoke first. He observed that in the German language, his native tongue, there is one word that means both power and violence. In my life, he explained, I have seen the constant coexistence of these two, power and violence, and I have seen the tragedies that have resulted. The question I am left with is this: is it possible to separate the two? Must power always lead to violence? It is a question I have been pondering since the day in 2005 when he asked it. Long before Jesus preached of the power of servanthood in the kingdom of God, the prophet Jeremiah spoke out against kings, the kings of his day, who used their power for destructive purposes. Using a shepherd as an analogy for the king, Jeremiah describes how the rulers have scattered and destroyed the great sheep of Israel. Drunk on their own power, they had turned to violence and oppression as a means for gaining even greater control. To these kings, Jeremiah speaks divine words of ominous warning. I will attend to your evil doings. You might expect at this point a description of the punishment that is due these kings, but God turns instead to the sheep of Israel. I myself will gather the remnant of these flocks, and I myself will bring them back to their fold. The promise of God in the prophet Jeremiah, the life of Jesus Christ, God promises to be a shepherd king, to bring a pastoral reign of peace and well-being. Jeremiah's vision of a peaceful pastoral kingdom and Jesus' words of forgiveness from the cross point to a power that does not rely on violence or coercion. They describe a kingdom not built on inequality and injustice, but on hospitality and grace. Jesus, in his life and in his death, offers a different vision to those of us who dare follow him. Friends, if Christ is king, then all our other allegiances must be called into question. If Christ is Lord of all, then his reign cannot be limited to my personal walk of faith or my personal salvation. To submit to the sovereignty of Christ is to seek to embody his love in all parts of our lives. Presbyterians have always affirmed the active work of God in what our church constitution calls the broader realms of culture and society. Here is a kingdom that does not end at the doors of the church. Here is a call to live each day as if standing on sacred, holy ground, wherever you might be. I've heard recently the ancient story of a priest who walked into an empty sanctuary to find a young man sitting in a chair with his feet propped up on the communion table. Angrily, the priest rushed over to the man and demanded, "Take your feet off that table immediately. That is a holy table. Where shall I put them?" the man asked. Our faith must impact our lives beyond these beautiful walls, because the truth of Christ's reign is this: the kingdom is everywhere. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, you will encounter God and God's kingdom in surprising places and in unexpected ways. I have seen the kingdom of God breaking through here at Morningside as we worship and serve God together, as we care for one another, as we show unity despite difference, and as we take our faith outside these walls to serve the community and the world beyond us. We have been so blessed in this church with renewal and vitality and strength, and that has enlivened us as a community of faith. We have all felt that. But now we must decide how this fire that has been kindled here will serve God's kingdom in the world. When we choose to be led by our faith into uncomfortable places, we give witness to the kingdom of God, a kingdom that has already come in Jesus Christ and that will come again and again and again. Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. A friend shared with me this week that her pastor was recently preaching a sermon on the 34th Psalm, which includes that great verse, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." For his children's sermon, the most dangerous part of any worship service is the children's sermon. For his children's sermon, the pastor decided to open with a question. The most dangerous way to open a children's sermon is with a question. What does God taste like? Well, first there was blessed silence. Then there was a great deal of laughter and silliness. Finally, three children raised their hands. Wearily and warily, the pastor called on the first. She said, "Air?" And then the second chimed in, "Water?" The third replied, "Bread." My friend closed her story by saying, "You know, a lot of people were commenting on the pastor's sermon after worship, but the best sermon of the day was preached by those children." Air, water, and bread. The stuff of everyday life that sustains us and nourishes us. God's kingdom is like that. Everywhere present, plenty for all of us as long as we share. Christ the King is Lord over the church, to be sure, but the kingdom that we seek and serve extends far beyond our reach and is as plentiful as the air we breathe, the water we drink, the bread we eat. professing Jesus Christ as King can be a dangerous confession of faith, because it will call into question all of our notions of what a kingdom should be. The kingdom that Jesus proclaims and embodies in the Gospel of Luke is one of great reversal. The poor and the mourning are called beloved people of God. The first are last and the last first. And in a stunning act of final reversal, the criminal is forgiven and given a seat at the great banquet of life. To honor Jesus Christ as Lord and King requires renewed vision of the world all around us. Call it royalty reinvented by the one who makes all things new. The humble shepherd is the powerful ruler. The lion and the lamb do rest side by side. People with little else in common are joined together as sisters and brothers in faith. And despite all the odds, the Prince of Peace is King after all.